From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, drones and the CIA budget battles in Washington, a post office pullback, and Karl Rove versus the Tea Party. John Brennan on the spot yesterday at his confirmation hearing for CIA director. He never used the word drone, but defended their use anyway.
We only take such actions as a last resort to save lives when there's no other alternative to taking an action that's going to mitigate that threat.
An impassioned, outgoing Defense Secretary Leon Panetta warned in a speech at Georgetown University that budget cuts from looming sequestration would have dire consequences for the military and beyond.
This is not a game. This is reality.
And a tussle in the GOP over the face of the party. As Karl Rove and Tea Partiers wrangled, House Majority Leader Eric Cantor worked on a kinder, gentler Republican branding.
Over the next 2 years, our House majority will pursue an agenda that is based on a shared vision of creating the conditions of health, happiness, and prosperity for more Americans and their families.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Margaret Tolliv of Bloomberg News, Robert Costa of National Review, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Where do you stand on drones, Brennan, Boy Scout, social policy, Saturday mail delivery? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington today, Margaret Tolliv, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Margaret, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. And from Washington, Robert Costa, Washington editor for National Review. Robert Costa, welcome back to you as well. Glad you're here.
Good to see you, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack. Are you in a blizzard yet, Jack?
Intimations of same. That's about it. Hello, Tom, Margaret, and Robert.
It sounds like this is going well beyond intimations. We'll see. The Northeast really braced as we speak for a very big storm, we're told. Let's go right to drones and John Brennan, very close to the President of the United States, who wants him as the next director of the CIA. Margaret Tolliv, what did you make of his reception before Congress?
What I made out of it is that the frustrations that were expressed are really about the program, not about Brennan, although the two were so closely tied together. When you compare his appearance before the committee with Chuck Hagel's, for example, he didn't flinch. He was prepared. At the same time, they are not going to discuss, certainly publicly and maybe even behind closed doors, a lot of the details that are at hand here. And, you know, the drone policy is something that a lot of Americans still don't know about, and that is sort of absolutely the future in kind of the post 9/11 planning. It was a really interesting hearing. And to me, one of the most interesting parts came at the very end when Susan Collins said that the CIA wanted to know which John Brennan are they going to get, the career CIA official or the Obama political advisor.
And what's the difference in her mind? What's she suggesting with that question?
Well, you know, I mean, that is a great question. And to some extent, it is a reflection of Republicans' frustrations that Brennan and the National Security Council have been a political force to try to sort of shape an Obama legacy rather than accurately reflect, you know, policy and what's been going on. To some extent, it's just an effort to untangle the politics from the policy. And he was, you know, a career CIA guy for a quarter century. He served Democrats and Republicans. For the last 4 years, he's been so closely affiliated with Obama's political team because the NSC really does represent the place where politics and policy combine forces. And if you're career CIA, if you're putting your guy's life on the line, if what you're doing, is secret and is kind of tricky and has to turn on a pin the way a lot of the stuff does, many of these guys are Republicans. Many of these guys are nonpartisan entirely. And I think because of Brennan's role over the last 4 years, because of anyone's role when they're in the NSC, the question for them is, are sort of exactly as she reflected, are we getting the career CIA guy or are we getting a guy whose interest isn't serving Obama and Obama's legacy?
John Brennan, very close to this president. This president, all wrapped around big use of drones, as you say, Margaret. But this week, lots of interest in particular about the policy guiding the use of those drones, and in particular, when they are aimed at Americans, as they have been to deadly effect. Here was Democratic Senator from Oregon, Ron Wyden, questioning John Brennan. Exchange focused on the legal justifications for deadly drone strikes, the killing of Americans, and whether or not those views can be made public.
I've asked you how much evidence the president needs to decide that a particular American can be lawfully killed, and whether the administration believes that the president can use this authority inside the United States. In my judgment, both the Congress and the public need to understand the answers to these kind of fundamental questions.
That never really got sorted out in these hearings. Brennan had already talked some about how and when drones are used. Here's the nominee for director of the CIA.
The president has insisted that any actions we take will be legally grounded, will be thoroughly anchored in intelligence, will have the appropriate review process, approval process, before any action is contemplated, including those actions that might involve the use of lethal force.
Robert Acosta, how do you see folks on the Hill sorting this out in the Senate? I mean, on the one hand, you've got big national security interests here, and the Obama administration is very aggressive in using drones to address them. On the other hand, you've got legal justification of a sort, half, still partly secret, for how these get brought to bear on Americans themselves. And this at a time, Robert, when we're told, well, you know, we're going to have drones overhead in this country, too.
The real Obama nominee who I think has trouble right now in Capitol Hill is Chuck Hagel for the Pentagon. When you look at Brennan's nomination, he had a flurry of activity this week around his hearing. But when I was on Capitol Hill yesterday talking to both Republicans and Democrats, I did not get a sense that Brennan is necessarily in trouble. Rather, when you listen to someone like Senator Wyden's comments at the hearing, it's more of a broader discussion right now about President Obama's foreign policy. And they're using these Brennan hearings as a way of almost investigating the president to ask questions of the White House about how they're handling their policy, especially on these drone strikes and the memo that was reported by NBC News. So I think it's a fascinating discussion right now in Washington about the Obama's second term, and the Brennan hearing has really given us a keen insight into how the Senate especially is looking at that.
I guess I'm less interested in what nominee is in trouble here, though Hagel's interesting too, but whether our Constitution is in trouble and how senators are looking at when law is secret, is it law? And when it extends to the killing of Americans, Robert?
It's a great point, and I think you're going to see already a public swelling of interest in this issue. I mean, for the president to only really talk about drone strikes on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart really was alarming not only to many citizens but to many senators and congressmen who wondered why the president was not communicating more with Congress, even on an off-the-record intelligence way, about what he's up to at the White House with his policy. But I think Ron Wyden has been hitting on these issues for a long time. But you're going to see some Republicans as well raise concerns and red flags in the coming weeks because they want to learn more.
Wyden wasn't alone in that hearing room yesterday, though some of the other voices were protesters inside the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing room. Finally caused the committee chairwoman, Dianne Feinstein, to briefly suspend the hearing. The fifth and last protester tried to show Brennan a list of people killed by drones.
All right. We're going to halt the hearing. I'm going to ask that the room be cleared and that the Code Pink associates not be permitted to come back in. Done this five times now, and five times are enough. So we will recess.
Jack Beatty, what do you think of that little persistent voice in the hall?
I thought it was the only morally alive voice I heard yesterday. I mean, you know, what is on that list? Well, according to the Bureau of Investigative Research, a British consortium of journalists, there are 2,000 to 4,500 names on there, including the names of about 475 children killed since 2004 by these drone strikes, and of course killed at an accelerating rate under President Obama. That's something to be upset about. And you know, this week, Jay Carney said something that I think he will be remembered for. He said, these strikes are legal, they are ethical, and they are wise. Legal? Well, you know, I think Colbert's comment on this really was the best one. He said, trial by jury, trial by fire, rock, paper, scissors, who cares? Due process just means there is a process that you do. The current process is, apparently, first the president meets with his advisors and decides who he can kill. then he kills them. That's legal? And then Wise, I mean, Gregory Johnson at Princeton, the Yemeni expert we've had on this show, says that these strikes in Yemen alone have increased by a factor of 4 the number of declared terrorists there vowing revenge against the United States. Even the administration concedes there's been a big buildup. In 2010, there were several hundred al-Qaeda members there. Now, according to the administration, more than 1,000. Now, even later, a few thousand. It sounds like it's not working. And of course, the view of these things around the world, I mean, in Greece, 90% of people opposed. In Egypt, 89. Georgia, Jordan, 85. And meanwhile, of course, offstage, 50 other countries are preparing to follow us down this road to drone technology. You know, you'd never guess that this policy is an ethical and strategic, debacle, but certainly controversy.
Margaret Tolliver, the nominee may not be in trouble. Is the drone program, or is Congress pretty well on board?
I don't believe the drone program is in trouble immediately. Of the three issues, legal, ethical, and Wise is the one that I think is the most interesting to debate right now, and I'll tell you why. Because it is not the taking out of selective people by remote control. It is the fact that these drones are flying above every day and that the people who live in these countries live with the drones flying above every day and they don't know when they're coming for them. And that is the sort of thing that over the long term breeds the sort of resentment and entanglement that really complicates U.S. foreign policy. And John Brennan knows it. All these guys know it.
Margaret Tolliver, please stand by with Bloomberg News. There, Robert Costa with National Review. Jack Beatty, we're looking at a week in the news. Listeners, you can join us. Did you get satisfaction from John Brennan on American drone policy? Is this the man to head the CIA? What do you think of the Republican Party's ripple of, rebranding? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, drones and a CIA nominee, Republicans rebrand, gun talk, sequester talk, blizzard talk, as we sit here right now. Margaret Tolliver is with us, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Robert Costa is here, Washington editor for National Review, and our own Jack Beatty. You can join us. What about drones? What about the Republican Party's ripple of rebranding, of infighting mainstream Republican Karl Rove versus the Tea Party? What do you think? Will Washington make a deal on sequestration or start chopping on March 1st? And who's winning hearts and minds on guns, on immigration, on gay rights and the Boy Scouts? Let's hear from our listeners on drones. Martin in Arlington, Massachusetts. Martin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Waiting for the snow here. Yeah. Listen, this is about overseas citizens of the United States, such as, I believe his name was Al-Waqi in Yemen.
Yes.
And so the point is, well, he's an American citizen. But the last time I looked at my passport, it said you cannot pledge allegiance to some other country. You cannot join the armed forces of another country. And if he isn't a member of the armed forces, then who is? They wouldn't even deny it themselves.
So it gives you no unease. I mean, he is still an American citizen. What about due process? You say forget it?
I say that he's abrogated any rights under citizenship. So write in your passport.
Bill, Martin, we've got it. Let me go to Bill in Charleston, South Carolina. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, sir. Hi. First of all, war is immoral, but he has been at war since Plymouth Rock, so we're a warrior nation. In regard to the drones, I would rather the drones be used than boots on the ground. Somebody's going to get hurt in war, and I would rather the combatants rather than our people. And in regard to drones used against American citizens in this country, does anybody really believe that's going to happen?
Well, I mean, they've been used to arrest people, not to kill people, but you know, when does the law get too fuzzy? Can you fuzz it a little and that's all right, but a little more and it's not?
Well, I don't think there's an answer to your question.
No.
I mean, a clear answer. I think it's all case by case. I mean, the drone strikes in Yemen, I think, are pretty clear. I mean, that particular person was seeking to destroy the United States.
Better drones than boots on the ground. Bill, we've got it. And one more, Nashville, Tennessee. Desmond, you're on.
I agree with the previous caller. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I agree with the previous caller. More better drones than troops on the ground, but there's a lot of hoopla about this memo that came out about when it's okay to kill Americans, and I think rightly so. But Americans' humanity is not greater than any other person's humanity, and I think the issue of the casualties during these strikes have to be addressed more and really seen as a real ethical issue, and not just, oh, that's just the casualties that you get when you strike on terrorists. And besides that, I think we're using too much force in this country. And I understand that it's terrorists, but I think as far as there are humans on the other side, there always has to be a place for diplomacy and talks, at least some effort put into it.
Desmond, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Robert Costa, what do you think about this balance? On the one hand, there are security threats, and you hear callers saying better drones than boots on the ground to address them. On the other hand, Margaret and Desmond in Nashville point out you can create enemies when there's a sense of constant, you know, up-in-the-sky threat from a big power afar. What about the balance of those, Robert?
I think it's a balance. It's always part of our political debate. And politically speaking, it's very interesting that President Obama came into office in 2009 as the almost anti-war candidate. He won the Democratic primary against Hillary Clinton because many liberals and progressives thought he had a better stance in the war, that he was against this warmongering machine that many on the left thought the Bush administration had done for two terms. And now in his second term, the president is continuing to grapple with so many foreign policy and national security issues that when he doesn't strike the balance that many of his supporters want, it almost seems like it's a betrayal. But the president, I think, is dealing with a complicated world. Just is he doing it in the right way? I think everyone has an opinion on how to balance the security issues in this country. But from a political perspective, the president's in a unique position because of where he came from and how he rose to power.
Yeah, it's a long way from the president who was really fierce in criticizing George W. Bush and Hillary Clinton, among others, saying he would not go down that road. Speaking of balance, Robert, let me bring you this new effort, the what's called the Conservative Victory Project. Karl Rove and others involved in this. Reportedly looking to getting big money from big Republican donors to finance campaigns to protect Senate incumbents from challenges by far-right conservatives and Tea Party enthusiasts who Rove and his crew believe may not be so successful in winning seats on Capitol Hill. Here's Karl Rove on Tuesday defending this organization to Fox News.
In races where it's important to have a winning candidate, it's to try and find the most conservative candidate who can win, the so-called Buckley rule. Our job is not to protect incumbents. It's to win races by stopping the practice of giving away some of these seats like we did in Missouri and in Indiana this past year.
But there was a lot of fierce pushback from Tea Party folks and others. Rush Limbaugh on Tuesday was having none of it.
The bottom line is they don't have any better record at picking winners than the quote-unquote amateur Tea Party types do. And even when they pick winners, what do we end up winning? We get squishy Republican moderates.
Rush Limbaugh. So how about it, Robert? I mean, I'm looking at just one here, Congressman Steve King in Iowa. Tom Harkin's not going to run for his Senate seat again. Steve King might do it, hasn't said yet. He sent out an email this week saying, "Friends, I am under attack. I urgently need your help to fight back. Karl Rove and his army have launched a crusade against me." What's going on inside the GOP here, Robert?
Karl Rove, with his America Crossroads and now this subsidiary called the Conservative Victory Project, is trying to prevent situations like he mentioned on Fox News. The Todd Akins in Missouri, Richard Murdoch in Indiana from last year. These are the Senate races.
Legitimate rape and all that.
Legitimate rape, exactly. And these were the races Republicans almost expected to win, and then they just became these colossal electoral disasters. Rove has a lot of money on the line with this American Crossroads group, and so he wants to be able to pick winners and shape being winners. But what's interesting to watch is that as Rove weighs in and tries to have a heavy-handed approach in GOP Senate primaries in the 2014 cycle, candidates like Steve King in Iowa, a Tea Party type, a conservative Tea Party favorite, may actually benefit from Rove's opposition. Because as Steve King did in that email you just mentioned, if they can have Rove as an opponent, then when it comes to the grassroots fundraising, they can actually score big. And so Rove, trying to maybe have more moderate or centrist candidates get the nomination, may actually help by being a real face for the establishment in Washington that the Tea Party can rail against.
Margaret Tullive, I'm seeing civil war in the GOP headlines here. Do you buy that? Is there a rift?
There is, and I actually see either a parallel or a broader story going on here. I'm not sure which of the two it is. Maybe it's both. But in many ways, this is about Republican strategist concerns about losing the business community and about losing, you know, Rush Limbaugh can call it the squishy moderate center, but how about like the center that finances campaigns and keeps the economy going? You're looking at these strange alliances, the AFL-CIO and the Chamber of Commerce trying to figure out a plan for immigration. What's that about, right? You're looking at, you're talking about, remember Obamacare, you can call it Obamacare now, but once upon a time, you're looking about partnerships with pharma, with Fortune 500 companies that want to get their healthcare plan straight, on immigration, on the debt ceiling. You're seeing, you know, CEOs who didn't want anything to do with Obama a few months ago traipsing over the White House to try to figure out how to lobby people to get stuff done. When business leaders who are not supposed to like Democrats like Obama are playing footsie with Democrats like Obama, it is time for the bulwarks of the Republican Party to get worried. And that's what's going on here.
Let's go. Yeah, Jack, please.
Right. I was just going to say, a poll out of Iowa this week shows the danger. Steve King beats all his potential GOP challenges handily, but he loses badly to a range of potential Democrats. Meanwhile, Tom Latham, also a conservative, but a possible candidate, he loses to a Democrat, Bruce Braley, but only narrowly, whereas King basically loses by a landslide. So there's the danger for them right in front of them.
How about, Robert, do you think this ends up moderating, or you suggest it may actually empower the Tea Party crew, and is that a path to victory anymore for the GOP?
I just say to Karl Rove, with great respect, good luck. Good luck trying to get involved in Republican primaries across the country. The Republican Party has really changed since the 2008 election. After McCain lost in 2008, you saw the rise of the Tea Party in 2009 and 2010. And they have really been emboldened. Even though they lost in 2012 and Republicans suffered an electoral defeat, conservative activists don't view the loss of Mitt Romney as a defeat of conservatism. So rather, they think it's a loss for the Beltway establishment. They're going to continue to fight against that. And so if Karl Rove, I just don't know how much sway he has in these primaries, even though he's trying to pour some money towards the more centrist candidates.
Let's go to Mike in Montpelier, Vermont. Mike, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just want to mention that I think that the Republicans' major problem is their lack of ideas and their vision for the future. I mean, I'm possibly, I'm a middle-of-the-road fence sitter on politics, and if they had some decent ideas, I may decide to vote Republican, but they have nothing but cutting the budget, and there they don't even say where the cuts would be.
But we heard Eric Cantor at the top of the show, Mike, saying, you know, talking sort of kinder, gentler about the health and happiness of the nation. What about that?
There's not enough specifics there. There's nothing there.
Let's go to sequestration on just this front and all the conversation this week. And Mike, thanks for your call. The president's saying, let's not go over that cliff. Let's do something to kind of push that out so we have more time to work on it. Here he was on Tuesday calling on Congress to quickly pass a new package. Small package of spending cuts and tax increases would block across the board reductions. The sequestration of the domestic and military spending set to begin March 1st.
In order to achieve the full $4 trillion in deficit reductions that is the stated goal of economists and our elected leaders, these modest reforms in our social insurance programs have to go hand in hand with a process of tax reform.
Now, there was some openness to this and some absolutely closed, folded arms to this. John McCain challenged President Obama and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid to bring the president's sequestration blocking plan to the floor of the Senate for a vote.
Bring a bill to the floor, then. The House has acted twice. The House has already acted twice to avoid sequestration. Tell the majority leader, bring the president's proposal to the floor. Let's vote and amend, go to conference, and resolve it. So far, we've seen no indication that the majority leader of the Senate would bring this to the floor of the Senate.
Margaret Tullough, you're covering up there, and Robert Custer. But Margaret, can you tell us what is going on here? What's the president proposing? Is there a chance of it passing? What would it do? What would Washington do in the extra months before, what is it, August, that this would put the sequestration off until?
When the president says a balanced approach, he's talking about raising taxes along with cuts. And the Republicans' position on this so far has been that they're done with the revenue raising for now. I have to admit that even though I cover this every day, I'm incredibly confused by sequester, the front end game, the back end game, and how it all works out. there are so many different things on the table, and you hear it's these sky is falling scenarios about what's going to happen. But then when people actually start to lay out what you're talking about, it's like, you know, frozen positions, freezes, and, you know, congressional pay raises. I mean, agencies have been preparing for this for months, even within the military. Yeah, outgoing Secretary Panetta is right to sound the alarm bells because that's the house he's protecting. But a lot of the things they're talking about don't seem like the end of the world, like, you know, cutting funding for air shows for a while or reducing some exercises. I think it's a if brought to its full fruition, probably would have a pretty severe impact on some domestic and some military services. But if kind of brought to half measure with some of the belt tightening that no one wants to take blame for, but hey, if it happens, every agency's been preparing for it for months now. I don't have a good read on how catastrophic it would be.
Americans trying to figure out what's going on here. If we're headed hurtling for a cliff, off the cliff or not, we'll keep probing, trying to figure out exactly what's going on. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Here was Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican, South Carolina, on Tuesday, trying to place blame for sequestration on President Obama. Of course, Republicans were involved in setting it up, too. But here's Graham saying that the nearly $1 trillion in cuts would hurt national security.
Our enemies would love this to happen. I'm sure Iran is very supportive of sequestration. I'm sure al-Qaeda training camps all over the world would be pleased with the fact that sequestration would gut the CIA and the intelligence platforms we have to follow them around.
Robert Costa, how do you see this playing inside the GOP? I mean, part of the original conception here was make the cuts so draconian, include defense, so Republicans would not accept this level of cuts and we'd never go over this cliff. Is that still where we are or not, Robert?
House Republicans are trying to play a chess game with President Obama. They never wanted these sequester cuts to take place, but now that it seems like they will happen, they're almost publicly willing to accept these cuts. Now, there's two things happening right now on Capitol Hill. Privately, many Republicans are complaining to the leadership, saying we do not want these cuts to happen. We employ many defense industry employees, many members of the military. If these cuts happen, it will be devastating to our districts. But then publicly, they're saying, well, we're okay with this if the sequester happens because these are real cuts. We promised the American people real spending cuts. And they're trying to push back on the president, who keeps saying, I'll replace the sequester, but it has to be with revenue or tax increases or tax reform. Republicans don't want to do that. So they're ready to let the sequester happen, and that's a real change of position from a couple years ago.
Jack, what do you see going on in this chess game?
Well, what's at stake, you know, is a million jobs. This is according to the Congressional Budget Office. That's how many jobs would be lost if this went, and not just in government employment, of course, but in the stimulation.
And maybe a full point off GDP
It would be an economic catastrophe, really, perhaps even put us back into recession. But, you know, I think the Republicans are putting themselves in a real box. If the president in the State of the Union on Tuesday says, look, we can go ahead with the sequestration, lose a million jobs, denude defense, all the rest, you don't live national health, whatever it is, it all goes down. Or we can have hedge fund managers pay taxes at the same level as their secretaries. Or we can stop the subsidies to the most profitable companies in America, namely the oil companies. In other words, he's got some stuff there that he can really, if it looks like the Republicans are saying to protect the hedge funders, mm-hmm. we're not going to, you know, yep. we're going to, I mean, that's a tough position.
Robert, we've just got half a minute before the break, but who do you think is positioning more successfully in this chess game?
I think the Republicans are, because so often for the past few months they've been on in the corner, backed into a corner. But right now they're telling the president, we're okay with these cuts happening, so they're in a better bargaining position.
So go on. Do it. Over the cliff we go.
Oh, well, it's not so much a cliff, because here's the key asterisk next to everything. They know that even if the sequester happens, they can always come back and reinstitute some of these defense spending programs.
Robert Costa with National Review. Please stand by there in Washington. Margaret Tolle, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Jack Beatty, we're looking at a week in the news. Listeners, you can join us. What do you think? Will Washington make a deal on sequestration or start chopping? Who's winning hearts and minds on guns this week, on immigration, on gay rights and the Boy Scouts? Did the post office have a choice? Did they have to cut Saturday delivery? Will you miss it? And should Chris Christie lose some weight? Is it our business? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Forget the postman on Saturdays. Except for packages, we're done with all that. The Postal Service lost $16 billion last year. By August, the Saturday letter in the mailbox will be history. And that's not all this week. Police freed the 5-year-old boy who was held hostage by Jimmy Lee Dykes for almost a week in Alabama. Here's the boy's aunt, Deborah Cook, on Good Morning America.
You know, if I could, I would do cartwheels all the way down the road. I would just... ecstatic. Everything just seemed like it was just so much clearer.
It was lights out for a long time at the Super Bowl. Here was CBS in the broadcast booth when half the Superdome went dark.
So we took that out,
put
it up there so that I could see it and that everybody else saw it. All right, we lost lights. All right.
We're going to a manual override.
Manual override. There was the moment, and the Boy Scouts of America delay a decision on admitting gays until May. Hot arguments on all sides. Ousted Scout leader Jennifer Tyrell of Ohio sees it going her way.
I have no doubt whatsoever. The delay is just that. It's a delay. So I guess now we'll just wait till May. For equality.
Maybe, maybe not. We will see. We're looking at a week in the news, drones and a CIA nominee. Republicans rebrand gun talk, sequester talk, blizzard talk in the Northeast. Margaret Tolliv is with us from Bloomberg News, White House correspondent there. Robert Costa from National Review, their Washington editor, and our own Jack Beattie. You can join us. What are you thinking on guns this week, on the immigration debate, on Boy Scouts, gay rights, post office, Saturday delivery? Should Chris Christie lose some weight? Is it our business? Are you bundled up for the blizzard? We've got listeners online thinking about things from all kinds of angles. Here, Steve says, how would we feel thinking about drones and the U.S. killing Americans abroad? American citizens, that is. How would we feel if China was using drones to kill Chinese citizens in the U.S. who they felt were hatching plots against the country? Well, makes you think. Let's go to Max in Boston. Max, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make a quick point. I work in the financial markets as a banker. And my thing is, talking to Republicans, it seems like they are very divorced from the reality of how financial markets really work. It's easy to read Ayn Rand and just think everything will be ideal if you go and cut, but not realizing that a country is not like a household. You cannot just cut when you feel like it. And the impact will be, the market will come and take care of everything, but the impact would be much worse. And I'll take my comment out there.
Max, I appreciate your call. Robert Costa, there's your businessman calling in. And as you say, there must be some business folks in the GOP looking at this situation and worried about it.
Republicans have to win a few seats to take back the Senate majority. And so they're looking at a lot of different strategies for the 2014 cycle. And one of the things they've done early on is with the National Republican Senatorial Committee. This is the NRSC. This is the group connected to the Senate Republicans that manages the campaigns. They brought in Ted Cruz, the Tea Party favorite, who was just elected from Texas to be the vice chairman. And they also brought in Rob Portman, the respected former OMB director, now a senator from Ohio. He's also vice chairman. And they're working with Jerry Moran, the low-key Kansas senator, to try to have a strategy that reaches out to both the grassroots and the business community, because they're going to have to find a blend of those groups to win next year.
And people thinking about all that, and people thinking about Saturday delivery of the mail. Martha, Farmersville, Illinois. Martha, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I used to work for a bank years ago. I know about velocity of funds. Checks are issued so that they arrive on Saturday. People who have Saturday mail can pick them up and maybe even bank them on Saturday for Monday transaction. But if they don't arrive until Monday, people who work won't be able to bank them until Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
This will slow down the velocity of funds and have an effect on the economy.
So you think just not having those checks in the mail there on Saturday to go in the bank and keep it all rolling could actually hit the economy, Martha?
Yes.
What about that $16 billion hole in the post office budget? What should we do?
Well, we have to balance things, and that's for the politicians to decide. But I wonder if they looked at the velocity of funds and how many checks are issued. so that they arrive on a Saturday?
That's a very interesting question. Slowing the checks, slow the velocity of funds, maybe slow the economy. Let me get one more. Thanks, Martha, in Farmersville. One more from Illinois. Springfield. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My father works in Houston, Texas for the post office. He's been there 35 years. They just had a meeting last week, and they were informed that there, as of August 5th, there would be no more full-time carriers delivering on Saturdays. The city of Houston is hiring 800 temporary employees to deliver mail on Saturdays, so they don't have to pay. They're going to pay the temporary people at a lower pay rate than what they're paying the full-time employees that are already tenured and have been there for years.
Hey, Matt, let me just ask you, that's a kind of story we can well imagine. We've heard that in other industries, but can you really have city employees deliver the federal mail, even temps?
Not city employees.
Oh.
The federal government is hiring 800 temporary postal employees that they won't have to pay benefits because they're not going to work them to the standard where they have to pay the benefits.
That's interesting. And after August, they won't even have to do that. Margaret Tolliver, was there a choice here? What's the post office supposed to do? Everybody's going to the Internet. How do you see them positioned?
Well, long term, you know, probably not real well, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as the other caller pointed out, I think it was Martha, there's some strategic aspects to a plan for Saturday service. Number one, there is an element of affecting business. Some of the private delivery services that have some partnerships with the post office, impacts on the economy. And there's also sort of the public sentiment. I mean, I don't know about you, but if I need to go to the post office, it's probably on a Saturday morning, right? Unless you're going to take the day off. And so if you're trying to get people's attention, this is certainly a way to do it. But I think underlying that, there are real long-term, you know.
To be fair, the post offices are still open. It's just the home deliveries, I understand, that's not there, yes?
That's right, that's right. But it's all part of the same thing. I mean, mm-hmm. the long-term trajectory of this has been, I used to work for newspapers. Industries change, and mail delivery is changing, and how people pay bills is changing, and how people communicate with one another is changing. And these are all,
issues
not going away with
this. There's only so much red ink they can swim in, too. I mean, Robert, is this the future for other services if we don't get things balanced?
Tom, I and many other Americans are not going to shed a tear about the post office closing on a Saturday. I think many Americans at least would be fine with the post office closing in general. I mean, the mail probably could be done much better in a private matter if it was done by a private company. Why is the federal government even involved beyond traditional cultural reasons in the federal government? Why is it even involved in the delivery of the mail? I love the Postal Museum here in Washington, but if the Postal Service continues to close down in days of service and shrink and it goes towards the private market, I don't think it's a tragedy.
But Congress is deeply involved in this. According to the New York Times, of the $16 billion loss last year, $11 billion of that was related to two payments that the post office had to make into its future retiree health benefits fund. This was a requirement of a 2006 Republican Congress that the post office pay up to pre-fund their retirement up to 75 years. They now have a $44 billion surplus in that fund, according to the post office inspector general, and it's more than enough to run it, according to Bernie Sanders, who points out that if you really look at it correctly, the Postal Service should be allowed to recover something like $13 billion in overpayments it's been making. The point is, they're forced to this straight on Saturday delivery because of this box they've been put into by the Congress.
I mean, what a world we live in. Why can't we get the right balance? We've got all these unfunded pensions out there, public pensions. And here's the post office on the other side of that line. Wow. Let's go to Aaron in Nashville, Tennessee. Aaron, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I work at REI, and we are excited about Sally Jewell being appointed to Secretary of Interior.
REI, this is the big, outdoor equipment and clothing manufacturer. You know, is she going to get nice new crampons on everybody mountain climbing in the West, Aaron, or what?
Hopefully. I think she's going to bring a really good balance to both sides of the spectrum from what it's going to require, maybe hopefully to get some laws put into place for drilling, as well as just being really paying a lot of attention to the environment. I think she's a really good balance, and we're really excited, happy to have her appointed.
REI, this is interesting. I mean, Margaret, here's a company that you know I associate with stores full of outdoor gear and cool kit for going on the trail. And now you've got the CEO coming in to be Secretary of Interior. What's her reputation, Margaret, when it comes to the environment and so on?
That's right. It's really funny that you said that. As we were standing in the state dining room at the White House the other day, watching him introduce her, I was personally trying to see whether she was wearing Merrells, but I'm really short and everybody was standing up. It looked like she was just in a suit.
But she used to work for one of the big oil companies. I don't remember
right.
which one. So what's where'd she come down?
It was Mobil, and she's an engineer. And so her reputation and talking to some environmental folks sort of before this nomination is sort of a balancing of both. Obviously, she's into conservation and climbs mountains in Antarctica and all that stuff, but she also has run a business and has had the oil experience in the past. So I think to some extent there's buy-in about her with all these different sectors. But when the rubber meets the road is when you really see how she balances those interests and how she comes down in terms of drilling and exploration, in terms of rulemaking for and policymaking for laws that are already in place. The thing to look for is that to such a large extent, we all expect the president to be leaning more on executive branch actions in the second term because it looks like it would be difficult for him to get a lot of legislation through Congress. So these agency secretaries and officials really may be very important in the next couple of years in terms of pressing ahead on what they can do with the powers they already have. And I think I think people are very interested in her, but I think precisely how she will blend those her experiences with oil companies, her experiences with business, and her personal affinity for the outdoors, it's to be determined. But I have not heard a real harsh critique of her, other than the fact that she doesn't have a whole lot of, you know, political experience. But she does have this grounding in these sort of three separate areas.
Jack Beatty, executive power and executives being brought in to exercise it, the head of a big outdoors company, but also banking and oil in her background. Mary Jo White coming in to oversee finances. Do you see tough action coming here, Jack?
Well, you know, Mary Jo White had a stellar record as a prosecutor on criminal matters in New York as a U.S. attorney, but she's been on Wall Street for now some years. Her husband is on Wall Street, and I hope that when the hearings for her appointment come up, that she's questioned on that. I mean, we don't want a repeat of what we had in the past of people who are just see things through the Wall Street perspective, because that ain't right for the economy, that's for sure. And as for this woman, you know, at least it's a prominent woman. I mean, my gosh, it's began as people said, the Band of Brothers, rubric.
The photograph of all the guys in the Oval Office, right?
Yeah.
There's breaking that band, at least. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Speaking of reputation, we had this interesting moment this week on Monday. Senator Robert Menendez, Democrat from New Jersey, responding to reports that he engaged in parties with prostitutes in the Dominican Republic and that he tried to inappropriately help a campaign donor win contracts. He was accosted by reporters in a hallway near his office.
Smears, that you were with prostitutes,
sir. The smears that right-wing blogs have been pushing since the election. But that's what they've done successfully. Now nobody can find them. No one ever met them. No one ever talked to them. But that's where we're at. So the bottom line is all of those smears are absolutely false.
Jack, what do you say? Is Senator Menendez being smeared?
I don't know about the prostitutes, but by God, the relation with one of his big campaign donors down in Florida, that stinks to high heaven. I mean, it sounds like he interfered with the State Department, he contacted the State Department on behalf of this person to have him pressure the Dominican government to grant a munificent contract to this Florida doctor in port security. What does he know about port security? Who knows? But it's the kind of thing that defines what goes on up there. You know, recently the Democrats released a sort of primer for new Democrats coming in, and they said, here's how you should apportion your day. 4 hours should be spent fundraising, 3 hours working on the floor. That's what they do. That's what they're all about. And this scandal in the making, I think, throws light on that.
Let's go to Ron calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Ron, thanks. You're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I want to make my comment on the Boy Scouts thing. The Boy Scouts are a private organization.
Yes.
And they are trying to help the kids to be all they can be, and they're trying to teach the kids how to be young men and everything, and mm-hmm. it looks like the gay movement, and which I love everybody now, don't get me wrong, but the gay movement is trying to force upon a private organization, and these children that belong to other people, they're private opinions on how they see sexuality, and like many people said, sexuality shouldn't even be in it.
Well, I take your point, Ron. You're not comfortable with the push for gay rights in the Boy Scouts because it's a private organization. But, you know, let me just ask you. There was a time when there were a lot of private clubs who wouldn't admit people of color. We did something about that. Is this different?
Hey, yes, it is different, Tom, because I believe now, it's my personal belief mm-hmm. that God makes no mistakes. If you are born a man, you're a man. You're born a woman, you're a woman. And these people experimenting with their own lives, not even want to push it on my kids and other people's kids. And Tom, and like I said, it's a private organization. They should have, if they really want to do that, Tom, they have access to the money. They can start their own organization.
Ron, we've got it. Our time is very short, forgive me. But Robert Costa, how about this? The Boy Scouts kind of over a barrel here. There's a lot of pressure on them now from both sides. What do you hear coming out of that? What must be a very consternated board of directors?
I think the Boy Scouts are just going to continue to be under fire. They have a very difficult path ahead, some divided board. I think whatever happens, it's going to be messy and recriminations among those who lead the Boy Scouts. I don't see this being solved with a lot of happy faces over at the Boy Scouts of America. But I think the trend is towards allowing those who are homosexual inside of the group. I think public support is probably leading in that direction, as you said, Tom. So I think they're going to probably go in that direction regardless of whether some members, such as the caller, supporters, are against that.
Jack, here's the sound of a culture, a country grinding through to new understandings, but it's a grind.
It is a grind, and we heard from that caller just how anxious it makes people. It's big change and big symbolic change, the Boy Scouts.
Listen, everybody in the Northeast, take care of yourselves this weekend. Everybody's talking historic blizzard. I don't know, but we will see. I hope you all stay safe. Robert Costa with the National Review. I want to thank you in Washington. Thank you very much for being with us this hour, Robert.
Thank you.
Margaret Tollev, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Always great to hear from you, Margaret. Thanks for joining us.
It is always a pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, strap those snowshoes on. Go wild.
Mush.
Mush, you Huskies. Thanks for being here, Jack.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.